The first eight guys maybe should be blue plate specials, but those back five guys, they should be more like tin hats, more guys that are grunt players, garbage players that dive for the ball.
You are listening to the Scrambled Eggs Podcast on CrackSidewalks.com.
Hi, everyone, and welcome into Scrambled Eggs, your unofficial Marquette basketball podcast here on CrackSidewalks.com, where two average podcasters talk about an average basketball team. Joe McCann and Phil Bush here to talk about what's going on with Marquette basketball. And boy, Phil, last week was frustrating, I guess, is the word I would use.
Frustrating is a four-year-old having his tonsils out and being home for a week. That was painful that week, last week.
Sounded like that hit close to home there.
I'm just pulling examples out of nowhere with no context or experience.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about what happened with Marquette in a tough week last week and look ahead to two games this week where the Golden Eagles really need to get on track or this thing, the wheels could come off this thing in a hurry. But still a lot of season to go. But Phil, I would start just with this general comment. I don't think the Seton Hall loss was quite as discouraging in and of itself as it is a road loss that Marquette was expected to have. I just think fans were frustrated coming off the Providence loss, which was a disaster, and they were just hoping that maybe winning at Seton Hall would make up for it, and then they didn't, and so that, like, the Seton Hall loss just kind of compounded the frustrations from the real mess last week, which was losing at home to Providence.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I also think part of it, the Seton Hall frustration was, like, they just seemingly couldn't get over the hump, and especially when they played what seemed to be really well in the first 10 minutes and had a pretty dominant lead, similar to Providence. I mean, with, what, 6 minutes ago in the Providence game, they had an 8-point lead that they gave back and ultimately ended up losing the game. So I think it's the fact that Marquette just can't seem to string it together, and in conference play here, aside from certainly a very good half at Villanova, and this is the inspiration for your intro, aside from one half at Villanova, or against Villanova, Marquette has played average basketball at best.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they're just kind of stuck in the middle right now, and I think maybe if you were, like, holding on to possibilities that this could be a Big East title contender, those hopes took a significant blow over the last week. As I think it's pretty clear that there are some teams a good bit better than Marquette in the Big East right now, although one of them is a team Marquette beat, which just makes it so confusing. The whole thing, I think Butler's kind of starting to distance itself from the field, but we can talk about Butler another day. But, yeah, I think the some of the coaching decisions late against Providence really frustrated a lot of us. There was not fouling up, went up three late in overtime that allowed Providence to get a three. The team did not apparently know to foul after Brendan Bailey missed that free throw that could have tied it. That burned some time, and then the timeout usage kind of split in hairs then because the game was pretty much over, but still, like, calling the timeout between free throws when Providence was on the line, thus putting yourself in a situation where you had to rebound and chuck it as opposed to calling a timeout or rebounding, calling that last time out, and then being able to go to the length of the floor and maybe get a prayer that way. Just seemed like the team, led by its bench, Wojo and the coaching staff, kind of bungled away that Providence opportunity.
Yeah, I think that's the frustrating thing because, you know, and there's always been a very vocal, probably minority on the social media platforms around, like, Wojo's a terrible coach, he can't coach, da-da-da-da-da, which you could largely ignore. But I certainly think, and I'm going to go through a relatively detailed list I pulled together of, like, just coaching blunders in the last 5.5. And I'm not saying this is an example of the disaster Wojo is generally as a coach, because actually I think he's an average coach at best, or not at best, but he's at least an average coach. But in that Providence game, and this is where it's so frustrating. So certainly there's an argument to be made, and the other part of this list, I would say, is they go up in increasing amounts of, like, insanity as to how the coaching decision was made. But so, like you said, the first was they didn't foul up three with less than 10 seconds, especially when they came up into the front court. you can make an argument either way. But the fact that you gave Providence a chance to win, especially when Brendan Bailey went under the screen instead of over the screen, like just, you know, brain cramps all over the floor on that play. So they tie it up. So then so they make the three with like 4.5 seconds left. You've got two seniors, a junior, and a 21-year-old sophomore on the court. And you call your last timeout with less than 5 seconds left for Providence to set up its defense. Again, I suppose there's an argument to be made. You set up a play and you go. But when you've got Marcus Howard and Sakar Anum and probably Kobe McEwen, I'd throw in this group, count on those three to make something happen in the last 4.5 seconds that gets you a bucket. Why are you overcoaching?
Yeah, and I'll just jump in here. I want you to finish your list. But no, the two things I want to jump in on. One, when asked about not fouling up three, his answer, Wojo's answer, did not do him any favors, because his answer was, I thought fouling with 19 seconds left is too much time, which is true, maybe, but that's when they inbounded the ball. The clock starts rolling when you inbound the ball, and so when they actually took the shot, there were only 6 seconds left. So I think when it gets under 10, the team should have been instructed, look, don't foul them right away, but when that clock gets under 10 seconds, if they're hanging around the three-point line, go ahead and make that foul. So I thought he hurt himself with that answer, because obviously there was an opportunity to foul there. And he also said that I was concerned that they were a good offensive rebounding team. That's why I didn't like that either. Well, I don't know if offensive rebounding teams make their mark on offensive rebounds off missed free throws, because that's generally 4-2 in those situations for the defense. And if, you know, Marquette absolutely had to get a rebound, I think you could throw, Jace and Ed Morrow. Had Theo fouled out at that point? I forget. But you could potentially throw all three of them out there if you absolutely had to get a rebound in that situation. So I didn't like that part of his answer. And the other thing I would say, that you said, you know, he called that timeout to draw up a play. Well, the quote-unquote play was just Kobe dribbling out the clock and chucking it. I don't think he even got it. I don't think he got it off anyway. So he called that timeout to draw up absolutely nothing.
Right.
Or at least nothing was executed anyway.
Right. And I'm pro Wojo on the ATOs, the after timeouts, but in that
Yeah, generally speaking, his track record is good there, yeah.
Right. But like when you have to go 94 feet in 5 seconds or less, I am 100% proponent of let the players play. Like it's a scramble drill anyway, just see what you get, let it roll. Right, and not let the defense set up and coach them up as the switch. The offense has the initiative in that case. So then the next on the list, but arguably both of those are, you know, on the margins. You can make an argument either way, and I wouldn't laugh you out of the gym. But then we get into the end of the game. So Marquette's down three. Brendan Bailey, I'd say it's a questionable bailout call, but he got the bailout call, shooting three free throws. On my list, I have these listed as two separate, just boneheaded coaching plays. But I will hear arguments from you if you want to combine them into one. But so Bailey's got three free throws. He shoots the first two. Mistake number one, Wojo then chooses to sub, effectively icing his own shooter. So that's mistake one. Then mistake two, he compounds it by not only subbing, but then does not sub in his lead rebounder on a rebound that he has to try and get if Bailey misses because he just iced him.
Okay, well, one question I guess I would have, like, on a three free throw situation, are the subs always, do they always come in after the second? Can you, like, in other words, if Wojo wanted to bring them in earlier, is that not allowed? Because in like a two free throw situation, the sub always comes in after the first one and not before it. So I'm wondering if that's just a rule that the subs always come in after the second free throw, no matter what. It's not like you can't sub after the first, is what I'm asking. That may be a vagary in the rules that I'm not sure about.
Yeah. Okay, that's fair. That could be correct. That you can't bring it in. But if you choose to sub, why is he not subbing in his best rebounder when he needs a rebound if Bailey should miss it?
Fair question.
It's like he overcoached then undercoached within nanoseconds of each other.
Yeah, it's almost like you know, the plan was he's definitely making this third one,
right?
Because like he put in a lineup that would be able to run and you know, a scramble drill and defend, as opposed to and definitely no one really. Sakaar was the only guy who went after the ball after the miss.
Correct.
Like everyone else started running the other way.
Right. Everyone bailed out, nobody, and again, this is where you can coach. When there's three free throws, there's plenty of time to pull Marcus over and say, hey, listen, if he misses the third one, we've got a crash, or, you know, or
now,
whatever.
I will say this in his defense, because I did remember watching the replay and saw how that broke down. Now, in, like, the guys in the defense of the guys in the backcourt, like Marcus, they do have to cover a man, because otherwise the guys can just, you know, outlet pass, and then the game's definitely over.
No,
so
I
you
agree.
Do have to cover the so Marcus and Kobe definitely had to stay back there on their guys. I hate to only put it on one guy, but the fact is the guy who messed up the most there was Kane. Kane was the guy who was in the lane and in closest position to the rebounder, but started running the other way. Sakaar was on the opposite side of the rebound, so he had to go like across the lane to get to the rebounder and around a Seton Hall player or a Providence player. So he had the farthest to go, and he was actually the guy who finally, I think, did get the foul, but he had to make up some ground in like 2 or 3 seconds. Jamal Kane was closest to the rebounder, and if he had been aware that he could have gotten that foul in 1 or 2 seconds, but he went running the other way, and that's what cost Marquette 3+ seconds, and that's it. Situation.
Right. I guess what I'm saying is, like, if you don't want to shout across the court and distract Brendan, you know, hey, get the rebound if he misses. Like, what I'm saying is, you know, call Marcus over, be like, hey, go remind everyone, and then Marcus can go, you know, hey, guys, you got to crash the board or whatever, right? That's what I mean, because I agree, the guards have to guard in the backcourt.
But in also, there were no... There wasn't a freshman on the floor there. Everybody should know you got a rebound, and everybody should know the situation. You know, you can't just – yeah. Jamal Kane, I love the guy, but he's a junior. He should know that situation. He has to be aware and has to foul there. Now, they may still lose the game anyway, but maybe we're nitpicking at this point. But still, that's just a – it looks poorly on the team overall when you just have brain farts in critical situations like that.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, and then the last one, again, this is the last mistake, and this could be, to your point, overly nitpicky, but so when Providence was shooting free throws with 1.7 seconds left, Mojo inexplicably used his last timeout, I guess, to freeze the free throw shooter, but the free throw shooter was going to miss intentionally anyways. Why would you not take your timeout? If they intentionally miss, get the rebound, call timeout, and then at worst case scenario, you're setting up some sort of wacky inbound play with a second and a half left. There's no way out of a rebound off of a free throw, you're going to generate any kind of forward offense that's going to get you a shot.
Yeah, you know, I kind of made a weird football analogy, you know, some of these late game situations where it's, do you go for two or do you kick the extra point or do you punt or go for it? You know, a lot of these situations, like the percentage of winning and loot, like the percentage that you're going to win is still low. You're talking like a 20% chance versus a 30% chance, but still you take the 30% chance. So like in that situation, yeah, the game is probably over. It's like 95% chance win probability for Providence at that point. But the odds of you getting a rebound, bringing it down, and chucking it the length of the floor to win, or, you know, are much worse than getting a rebound, calling a timeout, and then chucking it the length of the floor on a drawn-out play, a Christian Laettner-type situation where the clock does not run until the ball is caught. So let's say, like, you know, you get that rebound, 1.7, you call a quick timeout. Maybe the refs are generous and you had a 1.2 to get a playoff. You know, that's enough time to catch, turn, and shoot. As opposed to what all Brendan Bailey could do in that situation was grab it, come down, and then just heave a total prayer, which had absolutely zero chance of going in. So, again, yeah, we're maybe nitpicking. We're talking about a 3% chance of winning versus a 2% chance of winning, but still I think he made the wrong decision there.
Right, and I think it just – and the reason I really bring up that last one, to your point, you know, it's not a guarantee that they're going to get any kind of win out of that. But it's just the – what struck me, even live as I was watching it, was just the stacking of the coaching mistakes, right? Like they were just glaringly obvious coaching mistakes to the point where – it actually almost felt like it was an anomaly from a Wojo. I'm not used to this many glaring mistakes from Wojo. I'm used to some mistakes, but not where like you've got arguably six major decisions in a row that were just went the absolute opposite way of they should have.
Yeah. They really compounded there in that game. And yeah, it was very frustrating to watch. And I think the pitchforks and torches came out after that game a little bit, and they just kind of stayed lit all the way through Saturday.
Yeah, and again, I think it's because that was the first time where there was a really glaring, obvious Wojo problem there, and you know, within the social media, you know, Twitterocracy, if you will, of around the Wojo issue. I think it just was certainly a proof point in the argument that Wojo isn't the coach here. And, you know, you can argue the Seton Hall game was maybe not in a glaringly obvious way, was not, it was a continuation. I mean, there were times, especially in the second half of that Seton Hall game, where Wojo kind of reminded me of the Soviet coach at the end of Miracle when the U.S. is up, right? Like, he's just pulling his eyebrows like, what do I do here? Because he, like, he just ran the same stuff out and ran the same plays and expected different results.
Yeah, you know, maybe the Seton Hall game is more of a situation of just nothing went right.
Right.
Maybe just some of the players weren't executing. It was another game when the defense wasn't good, and the 3-point shooting was not up to the season average, and they just could not buy a bucket in the paint either. So tough getting a bucket inside. One of their worst games as far as 2-point percentage on the season, I think. Their second worst of the whole season behind the Wisconsin game. Barf. So, yeah, it's, you know, the first 10 minutes of that Seton Hall game were nice, but everything after that, woof.
Well, and I think the thing that was really frustrating was, especially compared to the first half, like the first half was all offense, no defense. The second half was largely all defense, no offense. And Marquette got 3, 4, maybe 5 stops in a row at one point to get themselves back in the game, and all they were able to do was, you know, change the margin from, you know, 10 to 8 or something like that. Like, they could never close even when they got stops, and it's like offense should not be the problem we're having with this team, but seemingly we are.
Yeah, it went away. Now, I will say this, to give a shout-out to Anonymous Eagle. They posted an interesting article, I think it was Sunday, Monday. I started to read it. I got distracted, wasn't able to finish it. But the sense of the article was basically this. Marquette's three worst defensive performances of the season as far as effective field goal percentage. Their five worst performances are their five losses. So if you ranked Marquette's performances by effective field goal percentage from best to worst, the five worst, those are their five losses. So in other words, put it simply, Marquette's five worst performances of the year on defense are their five losses. So when they play poorly on defense, they lose.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's kind of a continuation of the Wojo era, right? Like, can these guys play defense enough to win? And in the games we've lost,
yes, it is
not
a concern. You know, like, maybe there are possessions and just days when the team takes some plays off defensively. I think maybe when the offense gets frustrating, they let that affect their defense. And it does spiral out of, but it makes perfect sense to me. They're just been, well, in the games when things really kind of spiral out of control, it just seems they just can't get enough stops.
Yeah, I think the one thing I've noticed, and I had a bit of Marquette basketball therapy on the Twitter.com website today, on Monday, the 13th or whatever. But kind of talking through it, I think part of the problem is some of it is the defensive strategy, because I think especially Jamal Cain and Brendan Bailey, who I have a tremendous appreciation for. But I think they're outside their skill sets defensively when we are switching 1 through 4. Brendan and Jamal are good players, but they are not quick enough or fast enough laterally to stay with 2s and 3s, and God help them if they ever got switched onto a 1, which means that they're getting into a lot of cases where they're either fouling or their guy is getting around them, which is forcing help, which then allows the kick. I mean, if I'm changing anything defensively, I try and find a way to keep Brendan and Jamal from being problems on the perimeter. Like, I don't know if you got to stop switching and just accept that some teams are going to shoot over the top of us, or, you know, accept the roller on the pick and roll and, you know, try and do it that way. But I think that's part of the problem with the defense is just we're trying to do things with some of our players that just aren't quick enough to do those things.
Yeah, maybe so. It's a shame because the defense has improved quite a bit over the past couple of years, especially as Theo John has emerged in the paint. But I still think there are weaknesses on that perimeter. Marcus has never been a great defender. He has, the effort is there. He's just not a great defender. Kane is the guy who you would think, looking at his length, would be a better defender than he is. But he seems like he is out of position quite a bit. And Bailey, I think, is. Yeah, he shows some promise as a shot blocker for his size sometimes. I mean, he's not like a Theo John type shot blocker, but when he's in the post, I think he defends his man pretty well. But he does get lost out there a little bit as well. So I wish I had some better answers for the defense, because overall, compared to what we've been used to, the defense actually has been pretty good. They just don't force turnovers now is the big thing. They never really force many mistakes, which, you wish with some of these guys who could get out and run and finish on the break. I think I would love to be able to see Kobe and Sakar be able to get out on the break and finish with some easy dunks and layups. But this team never really forces mistakes from their opponent.
Yeah, and what do you make of the seeming struggle at the 2-point inside the arc? Marcus Howard, statistically, you can look at it. His 2-point percentage is way lower than it has been in any previous year. He just simply isn't hitting the layups and floaters and jumpers inside the arc that he has in the past.
Yeah. I mean, the easy answer, he is small. But the thing is, like you said, he's done it in the past. And maybe he's just not getting as many calls as he's used to. Maybe he's expecting a little more respect than he's getting. And as the school's all-time leading scorer, as a guy who scored more than 2,000 points in his career already, you would think maybe he would get a little more respect getting into the paint, but he's not getting those calls because, if he gets a call, then it doesn't go down as a missed field goal.
Right.
But as he does, he gets the contact and misses the layup, and it goes down as an 0-for-1. I think there are just a lot of guys on this team who just are not good finishers at the rim. Like, a lot of them. I don't know if we do have a guy, maybe Sakar, who's good at finishing in traffic. With contact at the rim. Other than that, I think there are just a lot of guys on this team who are just soft finishers. Sorry if that comes off harsh, but no one on this team is really strong at the rim. Maybe Kane. Maybe Kane can be at times, but
if he can get to the rim.
Yeah, he doesn't get to the rim as much as you would think for a guy with his length. Soft is kind of a dirty word sometimes, but when it comes to getting to the rim and finishing in traffic, this team is a little soft.
Yeah, and so just to throw a little bit, and this is a little bit on the fly math, but So last year, Marcus, as a junior, shot 43.7% from two. Not great, but, you know, whatever. It is what it is. And had 255 free throw attempts. This year, he's shooting 40.3% from two and has attempted 124. And there, boy, I'd have to do the math really quick. But, I mean, the argument is they're about halfway through the season, right?
Yeah, more than that. So they're, what, 30 games in the regular season? And we are, and we're at game 16?
Yeah.
17 coming up? So, yeah.
So just past halfway. So maybe a few free throws, a few free throws less than last year, right? 124, double it would be 248. So, you know, he's on trend for 240. So maybe shooting 15 less free throws, which is 7 less shots, but that's not a 30-point percentage difference in two-point makes.
Yeah. I don't have a good answer. He used to have that little floater in his game.
Yeah.
Maybe he hasn't made use of that as much lately, now that I think about it. Because that used to be a nice little weapon for him. Just getting in the lane, just throwing up that little floater so it wouldn't get blocked. I think this is, again, there are no stats to back this up and just kind of guessing out of thin air. Like, as a freshman, he probably got a lot of shots blocked, I want to say. And then as a sophomore and junior, that little floater kind of emerged as a secondary weapon behind his three-point shooting. I guess maybe he just, again, I don't have the stats for this, but just it seems like he hasn't utilized that as much this year.
Yeah.
And he loves his step-back twos, and he hits a lot of them too, but I don't know if he hits them at better than 40% or not, so I don't know if that's helping or hurting his percentage, excuse me, on the season. So, yeah, I don't have a great answer for why his two-point percentage is down, but you know, Paint Touch has pointed out on Twitter this week, his numbers against quad one opponents are just bad this year compared to last recent seasons. In other words, better opponents are really shutting him down.
Yep. You know, he's feasting on the lesser opponent. So, I mean, what it really says is on defense, there's some issues there, but then certainly on offense, Marquette is relatively one-dimensional. It turns out it's the Marcus show, and then maybe another player steps up in that particular game. But there is no, you know, and I even said as much on Twitter, and I'd be interested in your thoughts. There really isn't a second banana for this team, right? Like, there are players can be a second banana, but not one second banana.
Yeah, it's like a rotating second banana. And that's what we were kind of hoping for during that nice little stretch of cupcake games there late in the non-con, that maybe Sakar and Brendan were coming around. But not so much the last couple games. There is not a clear second option where that you would say a guy that this is Marquette's clear second best offensive player. Because it can change any night between Sakar, Brendan, Kobe, and then spot times here from Kane and Elliott. But yeah, teams are still content to say, look, we're just going to go all out on Marcus, and yeah, he'll get his 20-ish points. We need one of you other guys to beat us. And I want to say Seton Hall was leaving Kobe McEwen open all day.
Yeah, they were. Yes.
Yeah.
He had at least four looks that were wide open that, like, two of them I remember, like, he hesitated an extra second and still took it. You know, it was like, shoot that right away or don't.
Yeah, and looking at the stats, like, my memory's coming back to me on this game now. I was like, Marquette actually had a lot of wide open looks from three.
Yep.
And it wasn't so much Seton Hall made great adjustments in that game to get forced bad three-point attempts, you know. Marquette missed a lot of wide open ones, especially Bailey. Bailey had a rough game, man. One for eight. You're hoping that's just an aberration and not just a sign of a trend. But, they left Kobe open a lot, but he did hit 2 out of 5. You really can't ask much more than that from him. Same for Sakar, 2 for 5 from three. But it's hard to live with hard to win with a 1 for 8 from Brendan Bailey, a guy who had really shown a lot of promise from three in December. So that needs to be better. You know, more guys need to be stepping up as second options alongside Marcus Howard, and it just can't be a surprise every night as to who that guy's going to be. We don't want to get into the second half and figure out, okay, it's Sakar tonight. It needs to be a little more obvious early on, and then that should create more options for Marcus Howard in the second half if the opponent clearly has to focus on somebody else who has a hot hand. But I don't know. On the other hand, Phil, that's just what the team is now. It's
right.
You know, like, let's just let Marcus fire away, and if somebody else steps up, great. But otherwise, we're going to need him to shoot the ball 30 times if we're going to have a chance to win, and just steer into it instead of pretending that's not who we are.
Yeah, I guess, but I mean, I don't know. If that trend continues of tough teams can shut down Marcus, and maybe it's an argument to be said that we should have taken the non-conference differently, right? Like, you love the results against Davidson and USC, right, where Marcus went for 91. But I don't know, maybe we should have spent the offseason or the non-conference developing more of an identity that wasn't so Marcus-centric.
Well, the thing is, I think they tried to do that, but it was more against Central Arkansas and Grambling.
Yeah.
Where we saw those things.
Yeah.
I think the first thing was, you know, like, you know, on the other, you know, you need to win those games to have some kind of non-conference resume. So if you're going 9-9 or 8-10 in the Big East, it's fine because you've still got enough on your schedule to be a tournament team. So, like, you got to win those games first before you got to worry about experimenting. So, like, you know, in Wojo's defense, USC and Davidson are not really times for experimentation. Those times you got to get the freaking win, and that's when you got to let Marcus Howard shoot as much as he needs to.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I don't know. It's I don't know what the answers are. Do you have a sense of the issues or whatever? Do you think they're correctable, or are we just at a, this is what we are, we're going to have a couple of games like Villanova where we play really well, and we're going to have games where we're like, what the hell is this?
No, I think this is what we are. I would love to sit here and tell you that a second score is going to really emerge in the second half of this non-conference schedule is going to be, the rest of this the conference schedule is going to be great, but I can't say that with any confidence. It's like, this team is what it is, and it's going to be largely dependent on Marcus Howard blowing up or getting a surprise second scoring option from somebody else, but you just never know when that's going to come. And I think, it is going to be what really has been typical of the Wojo era. There are going to be some highs, there are going to be some lows, there are going to be some great wins, there are going to be some head-scratching losses, there are going to be frustrations, and then there are also going to be those little wins that give us a little bit of hope and think things might be turning around. But I think at the end of the day, Marquette will be 9-9-ish in the Big East. They'll be, they could maybe get up to 11 wins, or maybe they could fall back to 11 losses. Anywhere in between there would not surprise me.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what they are. I think that's kind of typical of the Wojo era. For better or worse, I think that's kind of what the program I see, like, indefinitely, honestly. There will always be talent on this roster as long as Wojo and Stan are here, because they recruit very well, and there will always be promising, talented players on the roster that give us hope and give us excitement and can give us some exciting wins and show signs of building a program. But I also think there's always going to be something missing, whether the team's not good enough defensively, whether they can't shoot from three, or whether they're weak finishing up the rim, or whether they don't have a big man. I think there's always going to be something missing. And I think for that reason, I think Marquette is going to be perennially
average,
somewhere between third and eighth in the Big East. I don't think they will ever be so bad that they're going to be 9th, 10th, or 11th. It'll be 11 teams next year. I don't think under Wojo Marquette will ever be so bad that they'll be a disaster like 9th, 10th, 11th. But I also don't think that they're ever going to be a Big East champion either under Wojo.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I see that.
Yeah, I'm starting to come around to your belief.
Yeah. And it sounds crazy to say that because they were so damn close to it last year. But you are what you are, and Marquette collapsed on the doorstep of a conference title last year, and so they still don't have one, and I'm not sure they're ever going to get one. I think that's just going to be the highs and lows of a Wojo era. And I was actually chatting with someone about this on Twitter the other day. Marquette fans might want to brace themselves, because I think it's, like, not by design necessarily, but I think Wojo's kind of set up to be middle of the road with valid excuses for another 3 or 4 years, because, you know, we've got this year, and, you know, if they finish 9-9 or so, the spin is, well, it was a good run, but, you know, you lost some guys to transfer in the offseason, and we really expected to be a little better. So we were really close. It's going to get better next year. Well, then next year, so we'll have the talent, some young talent coming in. We'll have Garcia, and who knows, let's play hypothetical and say Kareem Manet is also here. Well, there'll be 2 5-star freshmen, and that'll be exciting. But guess what? What was the excuse we got tired of a few years ago? They're young. It's a young team. They're just young. And next year will be the first year without Marcus in 4 years. So that'll be the excuse next year. It's like, well, yeah, I lost some games, went 9-9 in the Big East. But, you know, they were young. Yeah, things get better. It'll be fine. Oh, well, they're building something. Look at these 5-star guys. Well, then after that, if you have Kareem Manet, he may go pro. So he'll bail out. And maybe Dawson Garcia could be a one-and-done as well. And they'll probably have another decent recruiting class coming in. But maybe another struggle in the Big East, another middle-of-the-road type finish. And they say, well, hey, you know, we lost some guys to the NBA. It's tough going. Sometimes that happens. But we're still building. And so I think, you know, we could get to 2023 and look around and say, shit, we like this guy, but we haven't won anything in 10 years.
Boy, I got to go get a beer because, man, that is painting a picture. I mean, you're not wrong.
That's kind of the way I see it going. Like, I see all the potential to be consistently promising and consistently okay for another 3 or 4 years. Whoa. That's just where I see it.
Yeah, you're not wrong. I mean, do you make anything of?
I hope I'm wrong.
Well, I hope
they go
too.
I hope they go to the Final Four next year. But that's just kind of like rubbing my crystal ball. That's kind of what the direction I see.
But I mean, in that 3 years, do you see them making the NCAA tournament?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think thing is, one good postseason run changes everything for better or worse. Like you forget, like if this team, like say, totally bottoms out in the regular season this year, but gets in as a 12 seed and wins 2 games, everything is going to be great in this fan base. I'm telling you, it will be, because one postseason run like totally changes the perception. Shaka Smart is viewed as a genius in college basketball because a team that did not expect to get in the tournament had a surprise run to the Final Four. Don't forget, that VCU team that upset Kansas in the Elite Eight, that team was out to eat for dinner, not watching the selection show, when people called them and said, holy crap, you got in. And they went to Dayton and won a game, and then they surprised everybody and went to the Final Four. And that's why everybody believes Shaka Smart is one of the best coaches in college basketball. And now Texas is probably ready to fire him. But, like, that happens every year. Like, every year there's a mid-major coach who goes to the Sweet 16, and everybody's like, oh, somebody's got to hire this guy. Like, he's doing a great job. Where, like, maybe those people haven't even paid attention to what he's done in the regular season. Porter Moser at Loyola Chicago, great example. Like, I think a lot of people, when Porter Moser took Loyola Chicago to the Final Four, this guy's a great coach. He's going to be in a major program really soon. But I think people who cover that league have said, bro, look at his career record. Are you sure about that? He just had one great run here. So, like, in Wojo's case, one postseason run could shut up a lot of people. For better or for worse, even if they just barely get into the tournament, it doesn't matter if they have a good postseason run. So, yeah, like, while I am predicting maybe some mediocrity over the next few years, doesn't mean that can't include some postseason success.
Right.
Like, a win or two here. That is what I think this fan base is craving more than absolutely anything, is to be playing on the second weekend of the NCAA tournament.
Yeah,
I agree. And that would cure a lot. Even if this regular season continues to go the way I think it might, and that is like around 9-9 in the Big East, a couple postseason wins changes all that. And people say, hey, great job, Wojo. Got it going. Going in the right direction. And a lot of his critics may quiet down a little bit, despite what the regular season record may indicate.
Well, I mean, look at Marquette's own history, right? Like, go back to Crean. Crean really, all said and done, had one deep postseason run.
He did.
Yeah. Right? Like he followed that up with two not even in the tournaments.
Right. He did. And yeah, then, like he recruited and signed many players. I wanted like four or five players who were in Marquette's all-time top 10 in scoring.
Yep.
And none of those guys ever saw the second weekend of the tournament.
Yep. That, I mean, some of the players never saw the second game of the tournament.
Yeah, like Jamal or not Jamal. McNeil, James, and Matthews. They had two. They got to the second round twice.
Yes.
And they were one and done twice, if I recall, because like that freshman season, going off the top of my head, the freshman season they lost to Michigan State, or no, freshman season, that was when no, they lost to Alabama.
Yeah, they lost Alabama. Alabama. Yep.
Yeah, that was Novak's senior year, was their first year. So yep. That was they lost to Alabama as freshmen, they lost to Michigan State as sophomores, they got a win, and then that was the Stanford heartbreaker, their junior season, that was Crean's last year. And then Buzz took over for those guys the next year, and that's when they won the first-round game and then lost to Missouri.
Correct. Yep. So, like, we've been here before, right? Like, middling to decent, regular season results. Got in the tournament. Didn't do much in the tournament except for one magical March in 2003.
The difference is Crean had his he had his magical run in his – fourth season.
Right.
So like he had a lifetime pass essentially.
Right.
Because like at the time Marquette had not been to the Final Four in 25 years. So when you take a program back to the Final Four for the first time in a long time, I mean, you essentially get a pass for several years. And the thing is, none of Crean's teams were those first 2 years after Wade were tough, but the first year after Wade, he just didn't have anybody to replace him. And then the second year after Wade, that's when Diener broke his hand and all the wheels came off. All the teams with James McNeil and Matthews were actually really good. They just were just a little bit short, and they also had, it seems like they had like an injury bug every year. I want to say McNeil was hurt for the Michigan State game.
Yep, he was, yeah.
And I forget if somebody was, now I think they were full health when they lost to Stanford, but they took that great Stanford team with the Lopez twins to the wire. I mean, that was a six against Marquette was a six against Stanford a three, and they went toe to toe with them. That was just a tough draw. That team was good enough to go to a couple more rounds. Honestly, that was actually a really good team. It's just a situation where just the draw sucked for them.
Yeah, well, it was between that and the Stanford draw, and then the James breaking his foot. Those when they ultimately ended up losing to Missouri.
That was a Buzz team, but yeah.
Oh, that was a Buzz team. You're right. Because I was going to say, those two teams were the ones that like were uber talented that probably didn't go as far as they needed to. Whereas, one could argue the 2003 team outplayed its talent, but I guess no, I wouldn't say that. Just a great collection, right?
No, that 2003 team was legit as hell.
Yeah, they
were a worthy Final Four team. They were not overachievers. They were damn good.
Yeah. So,
but I think we're getting off topic here.
Yeah.
But yeah, back to Wojo. But yeah, like while I still kind of feel mediocre results are mediocre. Middle of the road regular season results, I think, are kind of the staple of teams under Wojo. That does not mean they cannot have postseason success, because far worse teams than this Marquette team have gone two rounds in the tournament.
Yep, I agree. But again, that's where it's like I still struggle with, like, what defines a good coaching, right? Like, do you want, if you finish top three in a conference like the Big East every year, but only make it to, the second round every other year. And
that's known as the Jamie Dixon.
Yeah, correct. So, like, is that what we want? Or do we want, a couple of flashes of glory in the tournament? Do we want occasional conference wins?
I think everyone remembers the postseason success, the NCAA tournament success, of course. But if you're asking me what's the greater indicator of a building program, it is the regular season success. It is consistent, because if I had a coach that consistently finished in the top three in the Big East, but was always out in the first or second round of the tournament, I would definitely stick with that coach and say, look, one of these great teams is going to hit. I would say Jay Wright was in that boat a few years ago, honestly. And like Jay Wright finally got to the final, not only got to the Final Four, but won a national championship, and now he's like Hall of Fame discussion. So yeah, I would say I would definitely take that over a coach that is regularly middle of the pack bubble team type, and will surprise you with a Sweet 16 every now and then. Because I think that's more bit of a fluke, although people do remember that more, right or wrong. So, but yeah, if you're asking me what would I rather have, I will take the consistent regular season success, top three Big East regularly, a Big East title here and there, and just trust that one of those teams is going to hit in the postseason. Like, I think if Chris Mack had stayed at Xavier and consistently had teams that were 1, 2, 3 seeds, he would have gotten Xavier to a Final Four eventually.
Right. That's also known as the Tony Bennett, right? Like,
yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. Tony Bennett, I would say, maybe was in that boat because he always had that, yeah, you're so amazing in the regular season, but your teams really never, they always underachieve in the tournament. Well, now he's got a national title and could pretty much name his salary at Virginia or take an NBA job if he wants to. So, or according to one of our friends on Twitter, take the Marquette job.
Well, sure. I mean, we can throw the bank at him. That's not a problem.
I honestly love all the interactions with all you guys on Twitter, but I just have to laugh sometimes. Seriously, in the last week, I have had people talking about coaching suggestions for Marquette in my mentions. I have gotten serious suggestions for Marquette about Doc Rivers, Jay Wright, Chris Mack, and God, there was one more hilarious one.
Oh, I got it.
I forget. It was one more that was just as ridiculous as Jay Wright and Chris Mack. But anyway, those were the suggestions I've been getting. Yeah. So I enjoy those, but those made me laugh in the last few days.
I'm just saying, like, I'm not against drug use. I'm just saying a little less drug use.
Pace yourself, kids.
But anyway, yeah, it's, I don't know. I think it's hard for people to accept. And listen, I'm the one that's Captain Optimism, and I was saying, oh, we're going to go win the Big East this season. Hey, we got to readjust. Now, I will put the caveat on. We've lost three games. Providence obviously was a bit of a stinker. We should have won that game. But we beat Villanova at Seton Hall and at Creighton. Those, now, maybe the fashion in which we lost them is discouraging, but losing to those teams on the road is not in of itself an indictment on the season, right? Like, there is still time for this to be turned around. But I think, like you said, it is an average team, and an average team means we're going to have some games that we win that we shouldn't, and we're going to have some games we lose that we shouldn't. And it's going to even out to something between 10 and 8 and 8 and 10.
Yeah. Remember, the definition of average is middle. Not bad. I'm not saying they're bad. They're going to finish 9th, 10th in the Big East. Average is in the middle. And I think they are right there, 9 and 9-ish. Maybe potentially go 10 and 8. This 3 and 4 start has everyone discouraged. That Providence loss is going to be one they're going to regret. But there is certainly opportunity this week to get back on track with a home game against Xavier, which KenPom has Marquette as a 5-point favorite, and then a road game at Georgetown. While we are predicted to lose that game, according to KenPom, that is an undermanned Georgetown team that I think is ready to fall apart, to be perfectly honest with you. Just got to contain Mac McClung, honestly, and everything else should fall into place. So opportunity to get some optimism back this week. And then going into next week when you're hosting St. John's, that should, I mean, honestly, I'm getting ahead of myself, but that is a great opportunity to win at least 2 out of 3, if not win all 3, before you go to Butler where, you know, reality will hit and hit very, very hard. But, yeah, Marquette is not going to, like, lose all the games for the rest of the season, so let's not, like, get into a total panic and just totally bail out on this team. There are opportunities for wins in this conference, and I think Marquette is good enough to beat some very good teams in this conference, starting on Wednesday with Xavier. Yeah, Xavier, good team, has some nice wins. Like Marquette, off to a real tough start in Big East play. their schedule is actually pretty similar because they have played Villanova, Seton Hall, and Creighton as well. The result's a little different. They lost to Villanova, but they lost to Seton Hall and Creighton like Marquette has. But although both of those were at home for Xavier, and they their one win was at home against Seton John, at home against St. John's, I should say. So this is actually Xavier's only second road game in Big East play. So maybe not quite as tested away from Cincinnati, Phil. What jumps out to you maybe when you look at what Xavier's done so far this year?
I think that they've been, they are even more inconsistent than Marquette is. And I think that, again, they've played the same type of competition. I just don't think Xavier has a very good offense, right? So, like, Marquette's defense, whether it struggles or not, should be able to keep up with Xavier's offense. So it's just a question, can Marquette outscore Xavier? Is really the thing to me, because their offense doesn't scare me.
What jumps out to me, polar opposites offensively, Marquette and Xavier. Marquette, elite from three, fifth in the country, abysmal from two, 321st in the country, according to KenPom. Xavier, terrible from three, 301st in the country, shooting 29.7% as a team. Not bad from two. Top 100 in the country. They're 90th. So that's not necessarily a shining number, but far better than what Marquette has. But yeah, Xavier, the promising thing there, they should not be a team that should be able to run away from you quickly by getting a bunch of threes. Their only real three-point threat is Paul Scruggs, who is shooting 37% from downtown, which would not even put him as Marquette's, what, fourth-best three-point shooter? Fifth-point best? Marquette has one,
they
two,
would be their, he, they would be
three.
Their fifth.
He would be the fifth with Jamal Cain right on his heels. Actually, no, six, because Samir Torrance. One, two, three, four, five. So he'd be their sixth with Jamal Cain right behind him. So percentage-wise, Marquette has far better three-point shooters than anyone Xavier has. Now, Xavier's going to try and get in the lane. They're going to get two-point shots. So, again, time for that block percentage to step up once again. That's going to be on Theo John, who I know is struggling with that hand injury. Also struggling with his foul troubles have creeped up again. He's had trouble staying on the floor because of that lately. Got to keep Theo John on the floor this week. He's got to be blocking shots. And when he does have to sit down, Morrow and Jace Johnson have also got to protect the paint. Or Xavier's going to be able to do whatever it wants at the rim, which that is the recipe for a loss on Wednesday. So that's how, but I do agree with you, Phil, that overall Xavier's offense is not intimidating at all just because they can't shoot the ball from three, so they shouldn't be able to pull away from you. Now, their defense is pretty darn good, 36th in the country, according to KenPom. So, and they are 27th in the country at defending the three, so that's a really good number. So you know they're going to get in Marcus Howard's face and try to limit Marquette's three-point opportunities. Easier said than done, but I am hopeful that Marquette is still going to get enough going offensively to defend home court on Wednesday against Xavier.
Yeah, well, and I would also say, though, that like Xavier also, their resume is built on, I guess I'll say, not a lot, right? Like there's not a lot of teams that they've beaten or many teams at all that they've beaten that are like top 50 teams, right? They've lost to the most top 50 team that they've beat Cincinnati, which is 43 on KenPom, and they beat TCU, which is 44 on KenPom. Other than that, anything north of 40 on KenPom, they have not won.
Yeah, they lost Florida on a neutral court. They lost to Wake Forest. Oh, that's kind of a bad loss. Wake Forest is not very good. But yeah, then they've really Their Big East schedule has been pretty tough, although most of it's been at home. But yet to start Villanova, St. John's, Seton Hall, Creighton, that's a pretty tough start. But to have Seton Hall and Creighton both at home and not get either one, that's tough for Xavier. And they lost by double digits both of those games. So going on the road to Milwaukee, this should be a bit of a step up for Xavier. Despite what we saw last week, again, ups and downs with this team. You can't just, like, hold on to the last thing you saw and think that's the way it's going to be every time out. different opponents, different matchups. I like the matchup for Marquette just because I think their offense is going to do more against Xavier's defense than vice versa. So I'm going to say it may not be pretty, but I'll say another tight win for Marquette. So I'll say something in the neighborhood of 73-71 over the Musketeers on Wednesday.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think, I mean, I'm not going to lie. It's very hard for me to be optimistic just generally. Like, I just feel not great about the team right now. But I got to overcome that. And I agree. I think they have the potential to beat Xavier. It's maybe not a favorable matchup, but it's certainly not a negative right. matchup. So I don't see any reason why they couldn't beat Xavier.
Yeah, so because it's at home, that's kind of the tiebreaker for me. Marquette has, despite what we saw against Providence, generally speaking, been very tough at home this year. Just ask Villanova, because that's when they played probably their best game of the season, was at home against Villanova. So then after that is another a game, maybe potential swing game as far as KenPom predictions. They have Marquette. KenPom has Marquette losing Saturday at Georgetown, who I don't know how much their stats may be skewed by the fact that they lost some guys, but maybe they had been playing a little bit. They did play a little bit better without those guys for a while, but then they got off to a tough start in Big East play. They lost to Providence, like Marquette has. They lost at Seton Hall, like Marquette did, and then they beat St. John's, and then they lost at Nova. They actually play Creighton on Wednesday, but again, just as we said a couple podcasts ago, Phil, I think the manpower on Georgetown is going to catch up to them eventually. Marquette is certainly much deeper than Georgetown. If you can just kind of prevent Mac McClung from going supernova on you, and so that's kind of, you put that on Kobe McEwen, that's his guy. Make sure McClung doesn't get going, and I think everything else should fall into place against Georgetown. Like, with all due respect, I know they, they've played much tougher since they had all those players kicked off the team, but they don't defend the three well. They shoot it okay, I guess. Still, I think man-for-man Marquette's better and certainly deeper.
Yeah, I think this is a case where the KenPom stats, you know, we always talk about at the beginning of the season that they're using too much of the previous season, so you don't trust them. This is one of those weird, because it just never really happens this way, one of those weird issues where we say late in the season, you can't trust the KenPom stats because they're built on the beginning of the season, right? Like, there's no way Georgetown's offense is currently playing like the 23rd ranked offense in the country, right? They're a different team than they were before those players left. So and oddly, I've watched a little bit of Georgetown play because they've either played before Marquette or after Marquette or whatever. There's just not anything other than, like you said, other than Matt McClung, there's not anything they do really well or that they do at an elite level or that kind of scares you at any, they're just kind of a team. Right. And so I think that's where Marquette has the opportunity. They can certainly outscore Georgetown. And I think while Marquette's defense struggles, generally speaking, I don't know that there's anything Georgetown has that can kind of take advantage of that Marquette defense.
Yeah. My only concern is if Marquette tries too much to get into the paint and Yurt Seven to start blocking shots all over the place, and if for whatever reason Marquette's 3-point shots just don't fall in a different gym. Sometimes that happens on the road. You're just not shooting the way you want to, and then if they start forcing stuff in the lane, they start getting their shots blocked. And because actually Georgetown is a pretty good shot blocking team overall. Actually, are they better than Marquette as a team? Might be kind of close actually. Georgetown 35th in the country, Marquette 69th in the country. Nice. So they actually, Georgetown is a team, bit better shot blocking team. So careful in the lane there. Georgetown can send you back the other way. But again, other than that though, there should be able to have a game plan in place where they can outscore Georgetown, maybe run them out of the gym. Especially if you get any of their guys into foul trouble. There just aren't many reserves on that bench to make up for that. Like, if you got to sit your seven down. If McClung has to sit for a while, there's just not a whole lot else there. So, but just because it's a road environment, I do get nervous about those always in Big East play. I'm going to say Marquette does kind of scratch out a win there, 4-point win. I'll say 79-75, something like that.
Yeah, I actually am going to go with a little bit wider of a margin. I think this week becomes kind of the zig to the previous week's zag, right? Like where everyone goes, oh my God, we're awful, fire everybody, we need to be done. I think this week coming up, we go the other way. We get probably a tough win against Xavier at home. And then I want to say it's probably a 10 or a 12-point win over Georgetown. So something like, I'm going to say 71 to, that would have to be 59, something like that.
Ooh, that'd be a comfortable win. That'd be nice for a change.
Yeah.
I can't predict that. Not what I've seen. But I think it'll be maybe a little more interesting than that. But.
Well, let's be honest. This is more of a pick against Georgetown than a pick for Marquette.
Yes, it is. It is that. I am also down on Georgetown overall. So, and that would certainly be nice to get back to 500 in Big East play, because then I think next week almost looks like a definite split with St. John's at home, Butler on the road. That is basically the yin and yang of Big East play. St. John's is a team that is, have they won a Big East game yet? They have actually.
I think they beat DePaul.
But they're, yeah, they did. Yeah, they did. Freaking DePaul. So they're 1-3, but still. But yeah, still, that's a game. St. John's at home is a game you've got to win. We said that about Providence last week, but they lost that one. But, you know, that's a game you got to try to make up one way or another by getting some road wins later in the season. As it is now, though, but yeah, it would be great to be back at 500 heading into the week when you play Butler on the road, which is almost a guaranteed loss. So I think there's opportunity. Don't give up on this team, but let's not start talking about Big East titles until maybe 5 or 6 wins in a row happen. Can we agree to do that?
Yeah, I agree.
So still going to make the tournament. I feel confident about that, even if it's not the kind of seed we wanted, somewhere in that 8-9-10 range, which is not ideal, but you may be at least in a situation to get one win if Marquette could do that. But first things first, let's just try to get a couple W's this week against X and Georgetown. So, as always, folks, we appreciate you listening to us here on Scrambled Eggs. We always appreciate your feedback. I'm Joe McCann 3. Phil is M-triple-O-F 23. Crack Sidewalks is the team handle. You go to cracksidewalks.com, leave your comments under the podcast. We post them there. Go to Apple Podcast, rate, view, and subscribe. And we also have a Scrambled Eggs Facebook page. Phil, do you have any more thoughts before we get out of here?
No, let's just not embarrass ourselves. Being real upbeat.
I think that sounds like maybe that should be the like Rothstein slogan for us. Marquette basketball. Don't embarrass yourselves. Till next time, everybody. Seashells and balloons.